Basic Brewing Radio is sponsored in part by the American Homebrewers Association. If you're into big, juicy, and hazy IPAs, you're going to love this limited-time offer. Now through May 31st, use promo code ZOMBA when you join or renew your American Homebrewers Association membership to receive a quarter pound of HS Zomba hops while supplies last. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing and use promo code ZAMBA, that's ZAMBA, to claim your quarter pound of free hops and find recipes featuring this tropical and fruity hop, perfect for late kettle and dry hop additions. Get offer details at homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. That's homebrewersassociation.org/basicbrewing. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, May 12th, 2022. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of the Homebrew Recipe Bible, Methods of Modern Homebrewing, and How to Brew Hard Seltzer, joins us to talk about yeast. In this installment on our ongoing recipe development series, Chris gives an overview of the most important ingredient in our homebrew recipes. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. Well, I said last week it'd probably be a little while until Steve Wilkes and I could get together for a video shoot, but Steve actually came up from packing to shoot a couple of video episodes and an audio show with me yesterday. So financial supporters will get to see an early release of the first one of those this week, along with a behind-the-scenes video and a recipe for the beer. First up is a version of a Bell's Two-Hearted Clone recipe. Brewed with a Simcoe instead of Centennial hops, which is what's actually used in the Two-Hearted Ale. You know it's going to be delicious, but how is it different, if at all, from the standard recipe? You know, what does Simcoe bring to the recipe that Centennial doesn't, and vice versa? We also shot a show on my small-batch lemon custard pie experimental recipe that was inspired by Steve's comments on the last tincture show. That one did not come out as I planned, but is that a good thing? No spoilers, at least not yet. Steve and I recorded an audio episode featuring tinctures in a dark beer this time. It was, we used wild blueberries, mint, and toasted coconut. That was a fun one and a bit surprising on some of those ingredients. Let's take a quick look into the mailbag. Listener Chris from Wisconsin wrote, after hearing Casey Letillier of Ivory Bill and I talk about brewing with the perennial grain Kernza, Chris says, listen to the show on Kernza today, and tonight on Wisconsin Public TV was a show about growing Kernza and brewing. Chris says the Wisconsin brewery using it is called Driftless Brewing. Well, that's very cool. A little bit of synchronicity there. Nice to know others are playing with Kernza in a beer. And I sent that info to Casey at Ivory Bill so he could know about that. Keith from Trail, British Columbia in Canada writes, in defense of the Corona Mill. You might remember Casey and I talked badly about the Corona Mill because he had to use one to mill the Kernza. Keith says, I really enjoyed the Kernza story. Triple is one of my 10 favorite styles, and I look forward to the tasting notes in an upcoming episode. I wanted to let you know there is at least one brewer out there who's still using a Corona mill these days. I got mine in the early 90s as a birthday present. The local homebrew shop owner told my partner, who bought it for me, said that it would last a lifetime, and I hope to hold him to it. Keith says it may be a little harder to adjust the crush, but not $200 more difficult, so I don't have the urge to upgrade. I've never had a Stux Barge because of the mill, and I bet if you did a side-by-side taste test against a roller mill, you wouldn't notice a difference, but that's a different show. That might be a fun experiment. Keith says, when you get your Kernza, you're more welcome to come by and use our mill. I'd love to have an excuse to go up to British Columbia. Keith also says, I also enjoy the recipe development series. For me, my breakthrough came because I was trying to copy a commercial beer or two. It was Big Rock Traditional and Guinness Stout that I was trying to make, so my friends could not tell the difference in a tasting using clear glasses. That meant color, clarity, aroma, and flavor had to be on point. Identifying the differences and trying to figure out what ingredient contributes to the difference brought it all together. That effort made me a better brewer. A black roasty beer with a twang and a creamy white head, not that easy to copy when your friends drank a lot of Guinness. That's a good tip, actually. And Keith isn't done. Keith says, also competitions helped me early on. I remember my first all-grain Pilsner that I entered in the Edmonton Homebrewers Guild competition, and the feedback was, nice beer, but needs more malt. It was all malt. How could I get more? Then I found aromatic malt, and we got a medal the next year. Quality feedback is so important to help you learn and adjust your recipes. Thanks, Keith. I appreciate that thoughtful note. Excellent points all around, and I apologize for disparaging the Corona mill. I've never used one myself. I just, it's just one of those things that you just hear over the years. This week's show is about yeast, and of course we can't pass up the opportunity to talk about our friends and sponsors at Imperial Organic Yeast. Casey at Imperial tells me they're extending the availability of L26 Pilgrimage through the end of May. You've heard me sing the praises of Pilgrimage because it did a great job with my passion fruit Pilsner and my toasted rye Doppelbock. And those were fermented at lager temps, but it's warming up across the country, but it still may be lager season. The Brewlosophy blog posted an experiment by Jake Houlihan recently that compared beers fermented with Imperial L13 Global at 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 10°C. And 72 degrees Fahrenheit or 22°C. Now, spoiler, statistically, there was apparently no difference between the two. Now, that was Global and not Pilgrimage, but that would be a fun experiment to try with the Pilgrimage as the temperatures rise with the weather. You know we love Imperial Organic Yeast. My stir plate is dusty because I don't use it anymore for making starters for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And if I pitch in the early afternoon, my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew shop about Imperial L26 Pilgrimage through the end of May and check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Okay, let's get yeasty with Chris Colby. Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
We're headed down the road talking about ingredients, but we're kind of running out of ingredients to talk about. But we're saving one of, if not the most important ingredient for last, and that is yeast. Beer yeast. You can't have beer without yeast.
Nope.
Okay, that's the show for today. Thanks for joining us.
All credits.
So arguably, yeast is the most impactful ingredient, right?
It certainly, when you, on brew day, you end up with wort, you know, a sweet a liquid or whatever, you end up with a sweet liquid. It's cooling it down and pitching the yeast that then transforms that wort into beer. So yeah, it's yeast is interesting as an ingredient, because although it's an ingredient, it doesn't end up in the final beer, at least not at any, you know, large amount. And it transforms, it's almost, in a way, it's similar to a processing aid, but it's an ingredient.
So what exactly goes on inside the yeast? How is it able to turn sugars into alcohol?
Well, the yeast cells have receptors on the outside of their cell walls that bring the sugars in, and then the sugars are fed through the Emden-Meyerhoff pathway and the fermentation. And so they take the sugars and they break them down through a series of steps that release energy and also eventually end up releasing carbon dioxide and ethanol mm-hmm. as the byproducts.
And there are certain things that we can do to modify the performance of the yeast during the fermentation. There's things that the yeast needs to be healthy and to do its job properly and not produce a bunch of bad tasting off flavors. It's useful for it to have a proper amount of oxygen, especially if you're doing a higher gravity fermentation. And it's got to have nutrients. But do we have to worry about nutrients, yeast nutrients, in a wort fermentation?
Well, I mean, nice thing about modern beer yeast is that they've been used, you know, generation after generation after generation to ferment beer and or ferment wort into beer. And, you know, the ones that had the most finicky sort of nutritional requirements, you know, got cast aside because brewers wanted something that consistently fermented, you know, their substrate. So most beer yeast these days, if you've got an all grain wort, if you've crushed some malted grains and made your wort, you know, straight from 100% malt, most yeast strains are going to be good with that and don't really need much help. If you've added a lot of adjuncts, a little bit of help, but, you know, by adding yeast nutrients can help. And also just, you know, if you just want to give your yeast like an extra kick, you know, you can add some when you pitch, just as sort of a prophylactic measure. But generally, with most worts, you know, especially a wort that's made, you know, all or mostly from grains, most yeast strains these days work pretty well without yeast nutrients.
And what about oxygen? What if the yeast don't have enough oxygen to work with? I mean, how can that be detrimental to them?
Yeah, there's the yeast need oxygen because they take that in and they use it to build these molecules called sterols, which help with the cell membrane flexibility. And so it allows them essentially to replicate because they add these to their cell wall. And anyway, so they need some oxygen. And it's interesting, they do save some, or they can. If they've been raised in an environment with a lot of oxygen, they do build up little stores of molecules containing oxygen that they can use. But generally, most brewers, you know, because you've grown the yeast, you're going to use up in a yeast brink or for a home brewer, a yeast starter. You're going to want to add some oxygen at the time of pitching because then the yeast will get it right when they need it. And most strains need about 8 to 10 parts per million of oxygen, which is hard to measure because a lot of, you know, like dissolved oxygen meters are not common in homebrewing. I mean, they're getting more common because the price is coming down. But, you know, most people just sort of wing it. You know, like I use one of those, you know, those little red cylinders of oxygen and a regulator going through like a sintered yeast stone or sintered stainless steel aeration stone. And I usually do like a minute of pure oxygen. And I just know by trial and error at the rate that I, you know, make bubbles and a minute that usually does it well. So, you know, other people need to, you know, you need to experiment and come up with that. But yeah, yeast need oxygen. And what happens if they don't get enough, it generally is they just have to work a little bit harder to get up to fermentation strength, and the fermentation will be a little weaker. It'll probably kick off more esters and or whatever else that yeast strain normally kicks off. So it's just whereas yeast nutrients are yeast nutrients are kind of optional, you really should aerate your wort thoroughly every time.
And I'm usually lazy, and if it's a moderate gravity 5 gallon batch, I'll just shake the bucket, or shake the fermenter, for a couple of minutes and make sure that there's, air into the wort. And I know that's probably not the best case scenario. But if you pitch enough yeast, that alleviates some of the demand for oxygen, right?
Yeah, it's all there's multiple factors. There's your pitching rate, and then the aeration. There's also yeast nutrients, and if you're and there's also larger oxygen demand for higher gravity worts. So if you're doing a low gravity one, you can get away with a lot. A lot of some people used to just when they cooled their wort, the tube. They'd run it to a bucket fermenter and just have the wort sort of fan out on the side of the bucket as it went into the bottom, and that was good for some aeration and then shaking. Yeah, the best case though is to either use pure oxygen, and pump it through an aeration stone, or use an aquarium pump and like have a put a HEPA filter in between the pump and the aeration stone, and usually like I don't know, 7, 8 minutes of aquarium pump on low should do it. And then I always swirl the carboy as I add either the air or the gas, just to help it get mixed in faster. And I also like use there's different sizes. I try to use the smallest of the commonly available sizes of pore size in the aeration stone to make smaller bubbles. And then I also turn the flow down to the point where it's not like big bubbles aren't coming out, because all a big bubble does is it just floats to the top and pops, and then that's gone. But I try to get the littlest bubbles possible and swirl the carboy, and then I just sort of look at the top, and I want the top to be sort of when the bubbles reach the top, you sort of see it, you see the top churn a bit, but not really a lot of gas breaking out, I want to get everything into solution, not just have it float up through solution.
Right. Now, we're talking about recipe development, and so knowing that yeast is going to be really important in obviously fermenting the beer, but also in adding the flavors that we want. What criteria do we look for in choosing different yeasts when we are brewing for a particular beer or a particular style?
Yeah, you want to have some idea of what your yeast is going to bring to the beer. Like obviously, if you're brewing a clean ale, what you want from your yeast is different than if you're brewing an estuary ale or a lager or a German wheat beer. So yeah, you have to sort of know what the characteristics are that you want are, and then you have to know the yeast strains that can bring you that. And there's most types of beer that there's multiple ones. And then thirdly, you need to know that you can alter those characteristics to some extent by all the things we just talked about, raising your pitching rate, lowering your pitching rate, more or less aeration, temperature, and those sorts of things. So yeah, it starts with picking the right strain, and then it's how you treat that strain during formulate or during fermentation that hopefully brings out the best in that strain, or at least makes it perform in the way you want to.
And different yeast strains have different alcohol tolerances. If you're brewing a big old barley wine, you want to make sure that you have one that doesn't peter out before it reaches the gravity that you're wanting to.
Yeah, it's interesting. Most modern brewing strains that you can buy have a pretty high tolerance to alcohol. Most yeast will get up to about 12%, and then you can do things to boost that a little bit. But yeah, you definitely want to, if you're brewing like a very strong Belgian beer, or some sort of experimental beer that's high in alcohol, you definitely want to take a look and see if that strain has been used, you know, has a high alcohol tolerance and has been used to ferment other, you know, high alcohol beers.
And you can manipulate that a bit. I mean, if you say mash at a lower temperature and produce more fermentable sugars, as opposed to mashing at a higher temperature when you've got some sugars that are, or some, you know, some sugars that aren't as fermentable for the yeast. So you can manipulate where that yeast ends up in the end.
Yeah, you can manipulate the fermentability of your wort so that you, if you want to say, if you want to brew a very high alcohol beer, you could sort of make a wort in the normal way, and just the ordinary level of attenuation is going to be such that the final gravity is fairly high, that there's, you know, that percentage of unfermented carbohydrates that in a pale ale yield a moderately full-bodied beer in a huge barley wine are going to yield, you know, a very definitely like a beer with a sweet edge. So you can mash for a higher fermentability so that you start out at the same high original gravity, but you ferment down to a lower final gravity. And that, you know, not only gives you more alcohol because you fermented through more of the wort, it gives you a somewhat drier beer, even though it's very strong.
And we talk about attenuation, and that is basically the ability for the yeast to ferment sugars down to a certain gravity. And that doesn't necessarily have to do with alcohol tolerance, right? I mean, you can have a moderate gravity wort, and you can have different yeast strains, and each one of those may ferment the beer down to a different final gravity, right? But it's not necessarily about alcohol tolerance, because it's below that threshold. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, you can take, let's say you brew 10 pale ales in a row, and they're all, you know, 12 Plato or, you know, 1048 specific gravity. So that's not stressing at all to the yeast. If you pitch, you know, 10 different ale yeast strains and they're all treated in the same fashion, you know, same pitching rate, same aeration, same fermentation temperature, some are going to just naturally ferment lower than others. They're just going to keep working on sugars, where others are going to get to a point where they just say, you know, done, and flocculate out. So
those are called lazy. Lazy.
Well, those are, I mean, like Y yeast 1968, the Fuller's yeast strain is that way. It quits a little bit early, and that's nice if you're wanting to brew a beer with a little more body and a little sweetness. But then there's, and I think that's WLP002 in the White Labs range. And then there's the, you know, the quote unquote Chico yeast, which is like Y yeast 1. I can't remember. I think it's the first one.
An Imperial Flagship.
Yeah. I don't know the newer yeast companies as well. Like, I love this stuff, but yeah. And it's whatever. It's the Chico ale. That, you know, that same yeast, if you were to do that side by side with the, you know, quote unquote Fuller's yeast, that one's going to have more attenuation. It's just going to ferment to a lower final gravity and get a drier beer. And yeah, and that's not, none of that is related to the alcohol tolerance, because I think both of those are reasonably alcohol tolerant beers.
And that's just genetics, right? I mean, that's just the programming of the yeast.
Yeah, it's just where their cutoff valve is, not a literal valve, but their, you know, their cutoff for how much, you know, are they willing to keep, you know, chugging away at carbohydrates in the wort, and at what point do they, you know, think, quote unquote, you know, it's time to shut down now and just wait for the next batch of sugar.
Yeah, it's easy to anthropomorphize things and think that the yeast are thinking these things, but
easy to do and fun as well.
I've got a couple of fun things to talk about from our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell and Havoc Meaderies in Vermont. First off, Buckland Mead is now available to order on Groenfell.com. It's set to start shipping next week. Buckland is made from wildflower honey, fresh lemon, and green rooibos tea. And at only 4.8% ABV, Buckland may be the world's most refreshing mead. Great for summertime drinking. And there's a big, beautiful handmade spring and summer seasonal collector's stein on Groenfell.com now, too. It's brand new, and this thing is really cool. It's 20 ounces and designed by Autumn at Singing Dog Visual Arts. And you really have to go to Groenfell.com to check this thing out. It's big and beautiful. You can also find a wide variety of delicious honey-based beverages from the sessionable to higher ABV meads, perfect for pairing with a feast with family and or friends. Check it all out at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's Groenfell. Along with attenuation, there's flocculation, too.
Yeah, flocculation is another important deciding factor in a yeast. Not maybe so much for recipe formulation, but in general, certainly for your process, because a highly flocculent yeast is going to drop out. And again, the Fuller strain that we were just discussing, very highly flocculent, and that's part of its attenuation deal, is that it starts dropping out when there's still sugars that other yeast strains can get at. And then in contrast, the Chico strain we're talking about is the exact opposite. That stays pretty powdery. That stays in solution longer and is less takes longer to drop out and drops out less hard.
Yeah, and it's fun to watch, different yeast strains, especially if you got like a glass carboy or somewhere you can see what's going on. Some yeast strains it just takes forever for them to fall out, to clear out. And in other words, they're done. They just drop like a rock.
Yeah, and some are like, the wort just becomes uniformly cloudy. And in others, the wort stays largely clear, and then the sort of big mats of yeast sort of churn up and down through it and ferment the beer. Yeah, it's interesting if you've got a glass carboy and a way to observe your fermentation when it's going on. There's a lot of interesting things to be seen in different yeast strains.
It's like a lava lamp or a snow globe kind of effect. You just, I get mesmerized by watching the beer ferment. There's also a self-congratulatory function of that as well. It's like, hey, I did it. It worked. So we're going to talk mostly about Saccharomyces. And there are sort of two-ish main categories of Saccharomyces yeast, right?
Yeah, there's for brewers, functionally, there's ale yeast and lager yeast. And that takes care of most of the beers that are brewed. There are other, like you said, there are non-Saccharomyces. Like you can brew a beer with all Brettanomyces, but for the most part, like most beers, certainly most beers that you would get on the shelf, are either an ale or a lager. And then there are craft breweries that make specialty beers with weird, oddball yeasts, but
I mean, you can. We've done primary fermentations with Brettanomyces before, and it gives different characteristics from if you were to add it, say, like in a barrel or in secondary fermentation. It seems to produce different flavor characteristics, and there are different strains of Brettanomyces as well.
Sure, yeah, people are. Experimenting with that. And I remember one of the first, I was at one of the NHCs, and it was the first conference I think they ever had on all Brettanomyces beer. And when they handed them out at first, I thought like, oh my God, this is going to be terrible. I was used to Brett being the sort of thing that added a little bit of diacetyl and the barnyardy thing that happens when it's a contaminant at a low concentration in wort. But turns out if you pitch a lot of it, like a full pitch of it, the fermentation characteristics are a lot different. And I remember that first, the first all Brett beer I had was very like banana estery. But it was nice, and it had some other weird, not weird, but it had some other other fruits other than banana in it. I would say like there was a little tropical fruit edge to it or whatever, and it was interesting. And then, you know, since then people have done a lot of experimentation with non-Saccharomyces yeast, and you know, there's still Saccharomyces still does exactly what you want in beer, and it's had centuries to do it. So yeah, Brett hasn't quite caught up, but you know, we'll see.
Yeah, and I think the first time that we had a 100% Brett beer, Mike Tonsmeyer sent it back when he was a home brewer, and I remember pineapple as being the dominant flavor characteristic of that, and we were just amazed at how delicious and fruity and clean and not funky it was. So yeah, it's another option. Now, but back to the ordinary quote unquote say ale. Strains for Saccharomyces, they like it a little bit warmer. And do we know why they like it a little bit warmer than the lager, their lager cousins?
Well, I mean, the ale yeast run the sort of gamut, you know, with the you can run them colder, you can ferment colder, and they sort of many strains at least approach a lager-like level of cleanness. And then of course there's certain strains like the Kvik strains or Kvik strains that you know, you can ferment at just incredibly high temperatures, and they produce you know, for the temperature, very clean beers. But yeah, I mean, I think basically ordinary yeast strains, the typical fermentation range that we run them in, it's lower than the yeast like, but it produces a level of esters and other fermentation byproducts that that beer brewers like. You know, the yeast is going to be happier. Typically, ale yeast would be happier fermenting at 90, but it's going to produce a beer that would be undrinkable, at least for most average ale strains. And then lager strains ferment colder because they're a hybrid between two different between an ale strain and another ale strain. That there was a non-beer brewing ale strain, and that actually happened in a brewery. Brewing lager beers, and so it adapted itself to the cold. And you know, because ale's the old, ales had been around forever, and lagers arose sort of within, well, I guess they both arose within the span of human species, but the ale much earlier in the human species than lagers, and they're cold adapted. And I don't, beyond that, I don't really know the actual mechanisms. But I mean, a big part of it is would be just, you know, basically trial and error. Just keep, you know, lager breweries kept, you know, pushing to brew colder and colder because they got results they liked. And if a batch didn't work, well, that yeast got thrown, and they, you know, replaced it with a yeast that would. And then whereas ordinary ale strains were, you know, likewise, there was the typical fermentation range, and the ones that produced the best performance at those strains that were kept, and the ones that couldn't produce a good beer at that were booted. And you know, it's just generation after generation of natural selection.
And we've taken part in experiments with the Brewlosophy folks, where they where they fermented a beer with a lager yeast strain, and they fermented it at typically, you know, quote unquote lager temperatures, and at ale temperatures, and the actual, you know, difference between those beers was, you know, statistically imperceptible. You know, so it. In at least some circumstances, you know, temperature on the lager yeast side makes less difference from what we have grown to expect over the years. So, and that may depend on the strain and the kind and the type of beer and things like that. So, you know, maybe, you know, within a certain temperature range, maybe, you know, the temperature range doesn't make as much of a difference as we thought it did in the past.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say that's a very strain by strain characteristic, because you know, like the old saying with you know, just ordinary ale yeast is that the warmer you fermented them, the more sort of the banana esters and things came out. And there are some British brewing strains that, you know, you can very much see that if you brew one at, say, 65 and one at 70, those are going to be two very, very different beers. You know, the amount of esters just ramps up with temperature quickly. But then you've got strains like the Chico strain, where if you do 65 and 70, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. Even if you crank it up to 80, you know, which most people don't, but you can do it. I've done it accidentally, and it still brews a beer that basically tastes like it's fermented with 1056. Mm-hmm. You know, so some strains are more responsive to changes in temperature with regards to the fermentation characteristics they kick off than others. And that's interesting about the lager strains, because I had always heard that if you ferment lager strains warmer, they tended to get ale-like. I mean, generally clean ale-like.
Mm-hmm.
But that's interesting that they could ferment a lager at ale temperature and get the same performance.
Yeah, we took part in, you know, they do triangle tests, you know, blind mm-hmm. triangle tests. And, you know, of course, I don't have the most accurate palate in the world, but but I couldn't tell a difference, and neither could Steve.
I suspect the two of you have drank some beer in your life, so I trust your taste buds.
Yeah, not sure if that's an advantage or a disadvantage, but yeah.
It better be an advantage, or I'm in big trouble.
You've lost that newbie edge.
Yeah, you could say that.
You've been around the block, and that block has a lot of bars in it.
Yeah.
So a German wheat beer yeast is a really good example at looking at how you can use a yeast in your recipe formulation and use these techniques that we're talking about to modify the flavor characteristics that yeast puts out, right? I mean, it may be one of the most not easily manipulatable, but it is probably one of the strains where if you change the parameters, you will see a noticeable difference, right? I mean, what are the things that you can do, parameters that you can change, techniques that you can use in, say, doing a German Hefeweizen to bring either the, you know, the most out of the yeast or to suppress it? I mean, what things, when you're designing a recipe and using that yeast, what are some things that you can think about?
Yeah, German wheat yeast strains, which are a subset of ales, are interesting because it shows you the importance of strain selection. Like if you wanted to brew a Hefeweizen and all you had was ordinary like British ale strains, there's no manipulation you could do to those to get them to produce like a Hefeweizen strain. So it is the strain selection that does that. But then once you start brewing with a German wheat strain, There's two major characteristics. There's banana esters, that's part of their profile, and there's cloves, which are phenolics. And additionally, some strains have like a bubblegum characteristic to them. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that as you raise the temperature or also lower the pitching rate, the amount of those go up. But the rate of ester formation actually increases more with rising temperature than clove formation. So what you get is at higher and higher temperatures, you get more and more banana-y strains. And then there's also strains that are balanced more one way or the other. And then, of course, there's pitching rate varies too. If you made a German wheat beer with a let's say you doubled your normal pitching rate and fermented at you know, the cold end of the range, it's going to be overall, that'd be a clove-like beer and very low overall characteristics, of the wheat beer sort of aromas and stuff. On the other hand, if you halved the pitching rate and fermented it at the sort of top end of that range, you'd get a very banana estuary wheat beer with, you know, you'd still be able to taste the clove, but it would be sort of mostly overpowered by the bananas. And so, yeah, it's interesting. Well, there you've got sort of a multi-way puzzle to solve. If you've got a very specific ester phenol, ester phenol or banana clove balance that you want, you've got to pick the right strain. Then you've got to pick the right temperature to ferment at, and you've got a pitching rate. There is, you know, and all three of those things play a role. And so, yeah, that's. I used to brew German wheat beers quite a bit, and it was fun and also sometimes frustrating trying to get, you know, a profile that I really liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've rarely brewed a German wheat beer that I liked or that it came out the way I was expecting it to. it was kind of frustrating to me. This past weekend, Susan and I got to spend time with Desiree and Dave of HighGravityBrew.com in Tulsa. We went to see Elvis Costello in concert at Kane's Ballroom. It was incredible. But before the show, we stopped by Pippin's Tap Room at High Gravity, and I got a flight that included Center of the Universe, no T in that, Center of the Universe Midwest IPA, Doc Brown Imperial Brown Ale, and This Aggression Will Not Stand Man, which is a light-colored milk stout. That has a T, stout, inspired by the White Russian cocktail enjoyed by a certain on-screen dude. And after that flight, I got a full pint of the This Aggression Will Not Stand Man because it was so good. And I'm just, you know, my taste buds are kind of in conflict with my eyes, you know, because I'm tasting a milk stout, but I'm seeing this lighter colored beer. Anyway, the good news is that all of these beers are available as kits on highgravitybrew.com. That's right. Not only is highgravitybrew.com the place for excellent Warthog brewing gear, you can find recipe kits that have been customer proven at Pippin's Tap Room, so you know they're good. And if you want to pick up some Warthog electric gear while you're at it, use the code EBC75BB to save $75 off your Warthog purchase. Show our friends some support as they've supported this show for many, many years. That's at family-owned and operated highgravitybrew.com. That's highgravitybrew.com. But Belgian strains are also very manipulatable. I need to pick smaller words. But Belgian yeast strains are also known for their flavorful characteristics as well.
Yeah, it's interesting if you were to draw like a Venn diagram that covered like a flavor and aroma of ordinary yeast strains, that would be like a, you know, that'd be, you know, like a softball sized circle in the middle. And then German wheat beer strains would be a much smaller circle, like just off the, like bubbling off that. But if you were to draw, you know, in the Venn diagram, Belgian yeast strains, it would be like a huge circle that sort of halfway encompassed, you know, the ordinary yeast strains. Because there's just a lot of different idiosyncratic yeasts among them, and their performance is very variable. Like I remember, there was this a brew pub in Austin, and they were making this IPA at one point, and my friends were like, "Oh, you got to try this," and I tried it, and I was like, "Hey, it's good IPA, you know, the straight up West Coast style." And then they said, "Try to guess the yeast strain that this was," and I was like, "You know, I don't know. 1056 and they were like, "No, it's they were using the whatever the Westmalle triple strain was."
Wow.
And you know, I normally think of that as, you know, the triples have there's a distinctive phenolic characteristic to that. And but what they did was, what the brewers did there is they found out, I don't know, by trial and error, or someone told them that if you just up the pitching rate of that yeast, it makes a very clean ale yeast. And it's also it has a high alcohol tolerance, and it's a workhorse yeast. I mean, it really, you know, at a brew pub, you don't want your tanks tied up forever. You want them to, So they could go with a relatively high pitching rate, relatively normal fermentation temperature, and that strain, which they were using in other beers, worked well to make a clean ale. And then of course, if you take that same yeast and you slightly underpitch it and ferment it at a fairly warm temperature, not ludicrously, you know, it gives you that nice triple style of beer. And a lot of Belgian strains are like that. They're very idiosyncratic, and additionally, some just like normal ale strains, some are very sensitive to the conditions, and others not so much. You know, others you can do whatever you want, and they, you know, like my experience with the Chimay like strains are that they over a reasonable spectrum of, you know, fermentation pitching rate, you know, or temperature and pitching rate, yield this roughly the same kind of beer, you know. But yeah, the others are, you know, more manipulatable.
Now you, that's contagious.
Manipulatable.
So on the lager side, if you're fermenting, you know, in the comfort zone for lagers to ferment cleanly, is it less critical, you know, which lager yeast strain you choose? Are they all similar in that way?
To me, yeah, the similarity of lager yeast is high. There's, you know, if we went back to the Venn diagram, that would be the smallest, you know, sort of circle if you're using ordinary, you know, because they're all meant to be, you know, clean, you know, quote unquote clean fermentation profile. And lagers are, you know, there's some difference, and some are have more attenuation than others, but lagers are basically on the edged a little bit towards the dry side. And yeah, you know, if you pitched at the normal rates and pitched at or fermented at the normal rates, there's less variation in the performance of lager yeast than there is in, you know, ale strains. And certainly if you pick, you know, sort of a clean ale strain and a very British ale strain, and then a, you know, German wheat beer and another like funky Belgian style. Yeah, and do, you know, four beers that way, you're going to get four very different beers. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you pick four of the most popular lager yeast styles and ferment them all, you know, they're going to taste like four lagers, you know.
And there's some sort of new experimental yeast strains out there that I've heard about. I haven't used myself, but there's like some genetically modified yeast out there that apparently accentuates some of the hop characteristics. Say if you're making like a hazy, you know, New England IPA, apparently that is, you know, one yeast strain that that people are turning to. And also I've heard of another one recently that is really kind of poor at fermenting alcohol, so that you could you know, do like a wort with a, you know, like 10-20 starting gravity and ferment it with that yeast and get a low alcohol beer, you know, that has you know, nice body and flavor characteristics. So there's still some new stuff coming out nowadays. So, you know, just keep your ears open, and there's lots of stuff to play with out there.
Yeah, I've heard about these strains, although that was like 15 minutes ago, right before when you were telling me about it right before the show. Why don't we add these things? Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
And we've reached the extent of our knowledge on those. So
I've actually read a tiny, tiny bit on the alcohol-free ones, and that's becoming an interesting segment among brewing, because not only are those beers typically you know, very, very low alcohol, but they're also low in calories, and so, you know, it can be an answer for brewers who want to come up with a low calorie beer that's still like, do you remember the like O'Doul's and all those old school, yeah, like alcohol free? Oh, those were just disgusting.
Yeah, they were bad.
I guess, I mean, I've heard that the newer ones taste more like actual beer. So I would be interested in trying one of those, and then even, you know, trying to ferment one of those if I could get my hands on the yeast strain.
Yeah, a friend of mine, when O'Doul's first came out, he went to like an Oktoberfest thing with a bunch of his friends, and they all pooled their money, and he stood in line to get pitchers of beer. And he said, "I got this new beer. It's called O'Doul's." And they were like, "What, you idiots?"
Ouch.
Yeah. And for some reason, he thought O'Doul's would be appropriate for Oktoberfest
Yeah, nice.
Now we didn't talk about it, and we may not talk about much other microbes that you can put into your beer. I mean, there's also the Brettanomyces, which is a yeast, but there's also and kveik, or kveik, or kvek, or pick one of those. It's a choose your own destiny kind of thing. But there's also lactobacillus, pediococcus, myctococcus. No, wait, that's something else. But there are these other microbes that you can put in your beer to also change the flavor characteristics, change the fermentation profile. So there are other bugs in the toolkit, so to speak.
Yeah, all the classic sort of sour beers were made with some sort of lactic acid bacteria, either one of the many species of lactobacillus, or sometimes with some pediococcus thrown in. And then also some of those were mixed fermentations, and there was also Brettanomyces in there, which didn't contribute sourness, but that overall added some complexity to the beverage. And yeah, I mean, people have even tried fermenting a beer like entirely with like lacto, and it's just, I mean, that's just gonna turn out like idiotically sour. And depending on the strain, yeah, who knows what else is it's in there, because there's strains of that are heterofermentative and homofermentative strains, and some of them just sort of straight ferment, and others ferment and also give off some other stuff. But yeah, they're bacteria is used in mixed cultures in a lot of sour beer brewing, and can even be used, as to kettle sour beers. And it can be pitched at a very high rate, such as in German Berliner Weisses. They culture the they don't just let it sour the beer in barrels or anything like that with a small amount of contamination. They grow starters essentially of the lactobacillus and pitch it at a relatively high rate.
Yeah, and of course, you can harvest your own yeast. Put a pan of wort outside under a bush or something, or under an apple tree, or use caution when doing so. But people are harvesting their own yeast and using it to ferment beer and starting their own thing.
Yeah, if you live anywhere near where fruit is being grown, you can take some wort out, and you can if you want to get just beer yeast, or not beer yeast, but Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is common in the wild, lower the pH of the wort to like 4.5 or something. It doesn't have to be that low, but that's gonna make sure that whatever grows is capable of growing at a lower pH, which is required for beer. And then make the wort just, it can be very low gravity, but enough so that the alcohol gets like up to at least like 1%, because by that time, almost everything else is going to die off except for brewer's yeast and lactic acid bacterias. And so you can do some selection, or you harvest strains from the wild and then do some selection. If you know actual microbiological techniques, you could, plate them out and then pick colonies and grow up individual tubes and try out the fermentation. And then, that your biggest problem would be most of them would have the what's it called, the POF plus or minus, I can't remember.
I don't know.
It'd be yeah, it's
You've
phenolic
stumped
off.
the host.
Phenolic off flavors. So if it was POF plus, then they'd have some weird phenolic flavor in it. But you could probably eventually find enough strains that had a where it's POF minus or some other set of characteristics offset whatever phenolics it was giving off, or maybe you like them. And yeah, so you can you can harvest your own Saccharomyces from nature. It's just it's a lot easier to go to the beer store and the homebrew shop.
Well, there you go. Thanks, Chris. Well, thanks again to Chris. I think we're going to start actually putting some recipes together using the information that we've learned in the recipe development series. So that should be a lot of fun to see how that works. What styles would you like us to tackle as we start doing that kind of stuff? If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, stay well. And stay tuned. So long.